United States versus Navarette. Prepare to argue? Prepare to argue? Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, and may it please the court, my name is Captain Zachary Gray. Together with Captain Joseph Borland, we represent the appellant, Specialist Jeremy Navarette. Chief Judge, if I may reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Since Specialist Navarette was released from military confinement in February of 2017, he has broken into a grade school, believing himself to be an FBI agent tasked with briefing children on counterterrorism measures. He's crashed his vehicle into a school bus. He's attempted to hang himself with a cord. On at least 4 separate occasions, he's been involuntarily committed to hospitals in 2 states, California and Texas, for a grand total of more than 16 weeks. And on 2 individual occasions, other courts in California have specifically determined that Specialist Navarette was, quote unquote, gravely disabled, which is defined under the California Welfare and Institutions Code as having a severe mental defect and being unable to feed, clothe, or shelter himself. And as if that wasn't enough, Specialist Navarette also has severe PTSD from an unimaginably horrible childhood, as well as from witnessing one friend accidentally shoot and kill another friend while deployed in service of the Army. However this court chooses to define the language substantial question, as used in RCM 1203C5, Specialist Navarette has met and exceeded that standard, and as such, the Army Court's decision to the contrary is an abuse of discretion. A court abuses its discretion if it relies on factual errors, if it applies the wrong law, or if its application of the right law to the facts is clearly unreasonable. The Army Court accepted appellant's facts as true, so it got that part right. But it clearly failed to apply the non-frivolous, good faith basis standard that this court articulated in United States versus Nix. And even if it did apply the correct standard, its application of the facts to that standard was clearly unreasonable.
Can we talk a little bit about Nix for a minute?
Yes, Your Honor.
Nix was decided in 1965. It was interpreting paragraph 122 from 1951. We then have the RCM that's at issue here, 1203, that was promulgated in 1987. So in light of that, that not only it wasn't simply a changing from paragraph 122 to the exact same language in RCM 1203, in fact, the language changed. And it changed subsequent to our decision in Nix. So why would Nix be considered controlling precedent? Now, it may be considered persuasive, perhaps compelling guidance, but why would it be considered binding precedent?
So, Your Honor, while not binding necessarily on this court, at least the CCAs have continued to interpret the substantial question language.
So you don't feel it would be binding on this court, though?
Your Honor, our position is that, no, it is not necessarily binding on this court in the strict sense of the word, but that it would be incredibly persuasive, and frankly, the trajectory. In 1951, your case law is replete with references to the preferred rating that mental health is given in the military.
But you feel as if the CCA still needed to apply the Nix language when it addressed this issue here?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that when the CCA looked to the language of 1203C5 and says, this is a substantial question, that substantial question is still defined as a non-frivolous, good faith basis.
But in the old paragraph, it was substantial basis, and it was should instead of may. So my point is, in light of the timing here, why wasn't it appropriate for the CCA to say, okay, we have new language since Nix. We're looking at the RCM promulgated by the president. And what this language says is substantial question. So we are going to use substantial question as the metric by which to measure whether a board is necessary, rather than saying we have to use the language from Nix.
Your Honor, I think that this court's determined, whether this court chooses to decide that the court erred because it didn't apply non-frivolous basis or because it erred in applying a newly defined substantial question, that even if this court were to go down that alternate route, that the Army Court's analysis or its application of the law substantial question standard to the facts in this case was still clearly unreasonable.
What do we do with the CCA focusing on the fact that he had received treatment? The CCA says, yes, this was a problem in the past. However, in the course of the treatment that he received in the California psychiatric facilities, that in fact he was treated, he was put on lithium and other medications. And what we've got in front of us, the CCA says, is that he now is in a relatively good stance. What do we do when we're applying an abuse of discretion standard and they're citing that? And we, as part of that abuse of discretion standard, we have to say that their findings were clearly erroneous.
Well, so Your Honor, I would let me kind of address this in reverse order. When as this court cited to most recently in United States versus Harris, the opinion that it issued 2 weeks ago, when it comes to the application of the facts to the law, that's a de novo review as well. So this court does review this case de novo, and as I noted at the outset, the Army Court accepted appellant's facts as true. But the fact that it relied on the discharge paperwork from Del Amo, I think, is perhaps one of the clearest instances of why the Army Court erred in this case, because it completely overlooks the fact that this discharge paperwork was not from normal voluntary treatment. This was from involuntary psychiatric commitment, where a California mental health court judge had defined, again, that he was so severely disabled that he couldn't provide the basic autonomic functions of life. So when this discharge paperwork, and the state cannot hold citizens, pending criminal indictment or conviction for willy-nilly, as soon as somebody is not, quote-unquote, gravely disabled, the state has to release them. And it still took Specialist Navarette 7 weeks to independent determinations that he remained gravely disabled for him to be released. So for the court to say that, for the court to cite to this paperwork that says he has a good prognosis, that good prognosis is a good prognosis that he will be able to feed, clothe, and shelter himself, and therefore he is no longer subject to involuntary commitment. It does not have any bearing on whether or not he can cooperate intelligently with counsel.
Counsel, as I understand the government's position, and I'm sure we'll hear a moment more, but the government's position seems to be that on appeal, before the CCA, your client's counsel was asked, well, what is the reason that you think that he can't participate in his trial, or what is the reason that you think that he didn't know the right, whether his actions were right or wrong? And the government's position is that there was really no answer to that other than that he has a mental illness. And I guess there's really two questions. One, do you agree with that characterization that there was no answer to that before the court? And secondly, is saying, well, he has a mental illness, is that enough to require a further inquiry?
So to answer your questions, one, no, we disagree. The mere fact that counsel filed this motion under the rules of professional ethics, counsel could not have filed that motion unless counsel believed that there was a non-frivolous good faith basis to believe that there was a non-frivolous good faith basis.
Was there one articulated other than just he can't participate or he doesn't know the right from wrong?
I would cite to the records from his Del Amo hospitalization as well as to his Encinas hospitalization that showed not just that he has bipolar disorder, but the severity of it. I mean, if you look to the Del Amo paperwork, in one paragraph alone, he uses the word severe 5 times to describe the degree of his tangential thinking, his delusional grandiosity, so on and so forth. So I think a good way to capture your question is to look at actually two cases, and I apologize, they weren't cited in brief, But United States versus Shaw, which was 64 MJ 460, and United States versus Harris, which is 61 MJ 391. And these were both challenges to guilty pleas. And in Shaw, the appellant made a passing reference to the fact that he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder after being jumped outside of a Waffle House. And on appeal, appellate defense counsel says, "Hey, wait a second. You know, there's a substantial question about the providency of his guilty plea. He said he has bipolar disorder." And this court looked at it and said, "The mere reference, you know, to bipolar disorder is not in and of itself a conflict. It's the possibility of merely the possibility of a conflict, and that's not enough." And if Specialist Navarette, under these circumstances, had just submitted paperwork, in his Rostopon matters, saying, "I have bipolar disorder, and therefore I think everybody mistreated me," then that would be akin to Shaw. And this court would be correct to say, well, in Shaw there wasn't a substantial question. Here, there's not a substantial question pursuant to 1203C5. Therefore, there's no further sanity necessary. In Harris, on the other hand, you had the entire adjudication of a guilty plea, including, importantly, a 706 inquiry that found Harris competent and responsible for his crimes. And it wasn't until he actually went to Miramar, where a watchful and diligent psychiatric worker pulled him in and actually did a diagnosis and said, "Hey, this guy has bipolar disorder." And this court ultimately kicked it back down to the convening authority, who had the military judge hold another hearing. That judge found that he was still provident. It came back up to this court, and this court said no. He didn't know that he had bipolar disorder at the time of the offense, and therefore there is a substantial question with respect to the providency of his guilty plea, and so it set aside the findings and authorized a rehearing. So I think if this court, those two cases bracket this, and if Navarette falls into one camp or the other, this is clearly on the Harris side of the equation. We have the diagnosis, we have general facts regarding bipolar disorder and the degree in which it manifests, and we have specific facts with respect to how it manifests in Specialist Navarette himself. And so all of that taken together, however this court chooses to define substantial basis, our position is that we have clearly met that standard, Your Honors.
Captain Gray, let me just ask a question in terms of procedure. Under the applicable RCM, it uses the word may. The appellate authority may order. So let's say, just for the sake of argument, that this court were to hold that there was a misunderstanding of the law and the facts on the part of the CCA, and we were to remand this to the CCA, and the CCA were to say, in its opinion, "Gotcha, we now understand, but even though it was severe mental disease or defect and all these problems that were cited by CAF are there, we choose not to exercise our authority to order the board." What happens then?
Yes, Your Honor. Under that case, that would, again, be an abuse of discretion, because that would be an error in their legal analysis of the RCM for two reasons.
So it would come back here.
It would come back here, Your Honor. And the first reason would be that the RCM 706 Bravo, which you referenced, does use the word may, but that is the procedural vehicle by which that rule accomplishes its principal goal, which is that the appellate authority may not affirm findings if there's a question if the accused is not currently competent. Now that's mandatory. Right? So the 706 or the post-trial 706 is a mechanism by which it fulfills that mandatory duty. But the second reason is that this court has already interpreted may language also in the context of 706B in United States versus Collins. And in Collins, the court looked to that same language, that the military judge may order a sanity inquiry despite previous findings, and interpret that to mean that the military judge had both the duty and the responsibility, now that's a quote from Collins, to order the inquiry. And in fact, in that case, case, this court held that the military judge abused his discretion when he failed to do that. So both under the case law, as well as a plain language reading of RCM 1203C5, it would be an abuse of discretion if the CCA were to just say, this is unfettered discretion, and we don't have to order it if we don't want to, Your Honor.
In your brief, you refer to case law that says that questions of mental competency are, quote, receive a preferred rating. What does that mean in terms of practical legal effect, that this has a preferred rating?
So this court discussed the preferred rating, Your Honor, in, again, that case, Shaw, noting that the military, the profession of arms, unique unto most professions, is likely to either generate or exacerbate mental health issues. And so when this court says that it receives a preferred rating, our position would be that legally it's, and maybe this is a colloquial answer, Your Honor, but when it's a close call, that the court is going to rule in favor of developing the factual record.
But what happens when you look back at the RCM that says that the presumption is that, in fact, they are mentally sound?
Yes, Your Honor.
So how does the preferred rating and the presumption play against each other?
So while the presumption may be from a starting point that there's the individual is mental or is sane, that the preferred rating is such that all an individual need do is come forward and proffer a substantial question, and then it's not for the courts. And I think the preferred rating language is kind of inextricably linked to this court's observation that the congressional intent behind Article 50A and all the promulgating rules is that if an individual raises these questions, then the courts are going to look into it. And our position is that is the common thread between the cases that have come down in favor of the appellant versus those that have come down in favor of the government. And that would be when the mental disease or defect was known at the time of trial and it was examined pursuant to a 706 inquiry, it's usually going to be upheld. When there is new information and there was no 706 inquiry, then the preferred rating would result in at least the service member's right to have the military look into that issue, Your Honor. I see that I'm out of time, pending further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Chief.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Lauren Carr, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Williams, we represent the government. The Army Court did not err in this case. First, the court properly required appellant to overcome RCM 1203 Charlie 5's presumption of capacity by raising a substantial question as to his competence on appeal. The court's finding that appellant did not meet that standard was not clearly erroneous, and therefore the court did not abuse its discretion.
What's going on here? First of all, why is the government spending all this effort to keep him away from a sanity board? This doesn't seem like a frivolous request. What's a frivolous request? A frivolous request is something that's totally without support. It's not, it's not couched in terms of a questionable request. It's a frivolous request. If it's not frivolous, he gets it. This guy's been through the whole nine yards of mental illness treatment. It's very hard to say from that a request is simply frivolous. Now, how does the government say it's frivolous?
Your Honor, the request is frivolous in this case because, for one, there's a good amount of information that appellant already has about his diagnosis that a board would not need to inquire to because it's already present.
That goes to the weight. That doesn't go to frivolity.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand.
Can I follow up on that? Because I did notice that argument on page 15 of your brief, where you say that the appellant's request for the 706 inquiry is frivolous and lacks a good faith basis because, quote, evidence of appellant's severe mental diseases and defects is already on the record. Therefore, further inquiry is necessary. Now, I guarantee you that the government, if there hadn't been evidence of severe mental disease or defect at all in the record, the government would be standing here and saying, it's frivolous. So why isn't this a case of the government saying, heads I win, tails I lose? There's already, you're saying here, and I'm quoting again, evidence of appellant's severe mental disease and defect is already on the record. Therefore, further inquiry is necessary. Could you please explain that argument?
Yes, Your Honor. So there are multiple questions that RCM 706 contemplates. One of the first is, what is the clinical diagnosis? In this case, we already know that appellant has bipolar disorder. That's unquestioned.
Counsel, don't you think that it's relevant that at the time of trial, when they did not have that information at the time of trial, and that part of the motion, I mean, I don't disagree that the appellant didn't even say, this is, I can't participate in appellate proceedings, but there is a different part to their motion, which is look at whether he had the ability to understand the nature of his actions, et cetera, and conform his behavior at the time of the offense for which he was convicted, right? And so how can you say that there's not a substantial question with respect to that?
Well, Your Honor, the government believes
they
that...
They did ask for that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they didn't know about the bipolar disease at the time of trial, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So
however,
why is there not a substantial question raised about that?
Your Honor, the substantial question language is not the same as the NIC standard. So I'd just like to back up a little bit, if I may. Substantial question in 1203 Charlie 5 does not come from NICs and that line of
I'm not talking about NICs. I'm talking about substantial question from the rule.
Yes, Your Honor. Substantial question is required to overcome a presumption that appellant is competent. So at this stage in the proceedings, appellant has to show substantial evidence to the contrary of that presumption.
You have a medical doctor in the writing saying that this bipolar disease would have a severe impact on people's impulse control.
Yes, Your Honor, but at this point in time, the rule requires that there be substantial evidence as it relates to appellant's ability to cooperate intelligently in the proceedings or communicate with counsel effectively. So at this stage, not only is the diagnosis a part of the concern, but the relationship of the diagnosis to the ability to participate.
But isn't that exactly what the board is for, rather than judges sitting at the CCA?
Exactly.
Kind of follow up on what Judge Ryan is talking about here. This is not a situation where the appellant is going before the CCA and saying, I hired my guy who was saying, I've got bipolar. These are physicians with the California health system incarcerating him essentially twice, involuntarily committing him. If we don't use the NIC standard, if we simply use substantial question, why isn't there a blinking red light there that says there's a substantial question? It goes to the point you're making of where's that interplay between bipolar disorder and the issues that we would be asking within the judicial system. But isn't that exactly why this board is necessary?
Well, Your Honor, the board is necessary to inquire into the maybe depth or impact of the diagnosis on appellant's ability to cooperate here and then also possibly even mental responsibility at the time of the crime. But when we look at the evidence that the Army Court also was able to review, you have documentation that is not only appellant's diagnosis, but documentation of remediation. Contrary to appellate defense counsel's assertion that the only information contained in those documents had to do with his ability to tell the time or do basic rudimentary tasks. The documentation actually stated that appellant had no hallucinations, no delusional content, no difficulty with impulse control, that his cognition was intact, and that his memory was intact.
Well, if all that's true, then what's the government worried about? Send him to the board, they'll find the same thing, and your troubles are over.
Your Honor, the government wishes to uphold the standard that requires that there be a substantial basis to overcome the presumption of legal competence.
Well, anybody who's been through this mental health drill for this amount of time, I think, has a non-frivolous request. Or it certainly seems to me it's non-frivolous. And doesn't that settle the matter? Isn't that the rule?
No, Your Honor. The rule is not the non-frivolous good faith basis standard. It is the substantial question standard of 1203 Charlie 5.
And all so, right, so it's a substantial question standard. I repeat myself, he's been through this lengthy drill, and is the government's contention that he's all better now and that this is just a waste of time?
No, Your Honor. The government's contention is that appellant has yet to put forth any evidence that would raise that substantial question to overcome the presumption.
So what would an appellant need to do?
What does it take?
It takes some facts that relate to appellant's diagnosis impacting these proceedings. Not merely that appellant has a diagnosis, but at some relevant point in time in these proceedings, appellant was either not able to understand or is not able to cooperate due
to
the diagnosis.
So is it necessary for those magic words to be invoked? Should it have been a situation where defense counsel then did hire someone, who a medical doctor of some sort, who would then say specifically the magic words you're saying, it's not sufficient in your view to say that someone here has a very severe mental disease in terms of bipolar disorder?
Your Honor, it's not sufficient to say that he has the diagnosis. However, I wouldn't go so far as to say that there need be a medical professional. Obviously, the medical question is reserved for later. But in this case, appellant defense counsel does have the opportunity to give those baseline facts which would establish overcoming the presumption. The ethics rules allow defense counsel to bring forth those facts which would be necessary to the representation.
So, counsel, is the problem here then that the appellant's counsel didn't say in his motion or otherwise the talismanic words he's unable to participate, to understand or participate in the appellate proceedings?
No, Your Honor. Not that they would need to use those specific words.
Or something like that.
But that they would need to present some sort of fact that would lead them to reasonably believe and put before this court that the diagnosis is impacting their attorney-client relationship.
Okay, but my separate question is, what about the request for them to have the 706 board look at whether he was competent at the time of the whether he was competent at the time of trial or at the time of his offense?
Your Honor, 1203 Charlie 5 kind of sets up a...
Are they permitted to do that? Can they look at that at this point?
Your Honor, the service court could order that to be a portion of the inquiry as well. However,
that was part of what was requested,
yes,
right? And it wasn't addressed at the CCA, was it?
No, Your Honor, it wasn't, and that's because appellant...
So how is that not an abuse of discretion?
1203 Charlie 5 requires a threshold finding that the substantial question was raised as to appellant's mental capacity at appeal. Because appellant did not get over that threshold question, the court could not order the inquiry and therefore determine if they should extend the subject matter of the inquiry into mental responsibility at the time of the crime. And so because appellant has not put forth that evidence that gives a nexus between the diagnosis and the ability to cooperate, not even in those specific words, but just generally, the government submits that the Army Court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the substantial evidence to the contrary was not brought forward in this case. Moving to...
Kevin Carr, I realize this is splitting hairs a little bit, but I just want to tease it out a little bit. So you've got a young captain, TDS, attorney who's assigned. separate from the legal standard that's applied, you're talking about them needing to say that it affected their ability to represent the client, this mental disease or defect.
Yes, Your Honor.
How would they know that?
Well, Your Honor,
how would the TDS attorney's interaction with their client, how would they really be able to understand? They know about the bipolar disorder disease, but how would they recognize how it has affected their ability to represent their client, or stated differently, how it has affected the appellant's ability to participate in their representation?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the record points to some indicators that counsel could use. It talks specifically about appellant having delusions of grandeur, hallucinations, and making certain behaviors that are the manifestations of his bipolar disorder. If the appellant's counsel was to see any of these manifestations in a way that impacted their ability to have an attorney-client relationship, a normal one, they could bring that evidence forth.
To what extent can an appellate court such as ours recognize that issues such as bipolar disorder, they're not constant? There are times when medication is helping and times that there are not, and that wasn't recognized either by the defense counsel or by the CCA.
Well,
by not getting the board involved, they are not comprehending the scope and nature of the underlying mental disease, and that it is not a situation like with TB where a person is cured. The person has the underlying disease and simply is not manifesting the disease based on medicine working at a specific time.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the rule requires that there have to be that nexus. The rule states that you have to have a disease or defect that then goes so far as to cause a problem with your legal competence. And so it's a required portion of the rule that the mental disease or defect actually go beyond just being present, merely existing. And so as a threshold matter, to assert that you believe that there is a substantial question as to that base level of competence, there would have to be some showing that the disease or defect had an impact. If it did not have an impact, then there's no basis to order the 706. And that is the question at issue. If there is no impact, then the court must go forward, even if appellant does have bipolar disorder, because there's been no showing that the bipolar disorder actually affects the proceedings.
Go ahead. If the bipolar disorder affected him badly enough that he had to be involuntarily hospitalized for a lengthy period, how can we deduce that it has no effect on his ability to comprehend, you know, leaving aside his mental responsibility at the time of the offense, that he can cooperate in his defense?
Well, Your Honor, I have two responses. The first being that the California courts, their standard for why they needed to admit appellant was different from the standard that exists in the rules before this court. Their standard has to do with appellant's ability to do physical things, take care of himself, understand the time.
Well, I would argue that if you can't feed yourself a fortiori, I don't think you can cooperate in your defense.
Well, Your Honor, I would just submit that I think that there is a relevant difference there. Appellant was able to drive his vehicle, albeit into a school bus.
Are you saying...
That might not have helped you, counsel.
Yeah. I'm saying, Your Honor, that it is possible for appellant to be able to do some things competently while still be impacted by his mental illness.
Well, no, so, but you're not answering my question. If he can't feed himself, how can he, a fortiori, cooperate in his defense?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, it sounds like he's down there at the drooling end of things.
Your Honor, at the point in time, he was. However, when he was discharged, he was not in that condition. He had a mental health plan in place.
Well, okay, so the government admits he was, but he's better now. Well, first of all, as Judge Olson pointed out, these things don't just go, they go like this. And secondly, it seems to, you know, why is the presence of this, whether better now or not, not enough to knock it off the frivolous end and make it non-frivolous?
Your Honor, at the trial level, pre-trial, during the trial, the government is most concerned with regard to these sanity inquiries as a way to ensure that appellant, then the accused, has every access necessary to defend himself, whether it be an affirmative defense or just the assistance of his counsel. Once we get to the post-trial level, the priority changes in that now we are concerned with the efficiency of litigation, the finality of these judgments. And that is why there is a burden to overcome.
Well, and I'm saying, having been through all the mill he's been through, why hasn't he overcome the burden?
Because he hasn't showed that his bipolar disorder actually affects this proceeding.
Is the problem, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't, that they've never said that it's going to impact his ability to, that the CCA didn't abuse its discretion because there's no allegation by the appellant's counsel that he can't participate in his defense in the proceedings?
Well, Your Honor, the court didn't abuse its discretion because in trying to assist appellant in overcoming the presumption, it looked at the evidence that was before the court, and none of that evidence went so far as to create a substantial question. Looking at the documentation about his medical background, he was not still in that same state, therefore it did not help to overcome the presumption that he was now competent. Looking at communications with his client, the counsel did not put forth any information related
to...
That's
what I'm saying, is that they didn't make the link.
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, the stuff is there in his medical records, right? But they never made a link between what was in the medical records and these proceedings.
Correct, Your Honor, because there's the diagnosis. There are the symptoms of the diagnosis, but in the same documents, there's proof of remediation and that appellant has regained competence. Specifically, when we're looking at things that are relevant to legal competence, such as memory, his cognition, those things appear to have been revived based off of the documents provided. So they do not allow us to, they're not substantial evidence to overcome the presumption.
Counsel, may I ask just one quick question?
Yes, Your Honor.
What evidence are we permitted to consider in deciding whether the CCA abused its discretion? What evidence of the accused mental health? I mean, anything after the time of argument?
Your Honor, you can look at everything that the service court looked at. Which in this case would be the medical documents from early 2018. And then additionally, the court looked at appellant's Gras Stefan matters to see if they presented any evidence that there was, that the presumption of competence had been overcome. And the Army Court looked at those documents and found that, in fact, there was no evidence to overcome the presumption because the mere presence of the documents, one, indicated that appellant had gone through the appropriate process that Gras Stefan requires to get the document filed before the court, and then also that facially the documents didn't indicate any sort of mental disease or defect that had actually presented a fanciful or otherwise completely untenable theory of relief within the matters themselves. And so this court can look at what the Army Court observed, but it's really only those two particular categories. Other than this court can ask appellate defense counsel to provide some sort of linkage between the diagnosis and the appellant's ability to participate at this point in time.
Counsel, I have one quick question. What's the government's view of the language in our opinions talking about a preferred rating, quote unquote? What does that mean in the government's?
Your Honor, preferred rating, I think, has to do with at the pre-trial and trial level. When we're talking about the necessity to give appellant every benefit in determining whether or not he has a defense, and You see that in 706, where not only a defense counsel could bring forth a claim that they believe there's a reasonable basis the accused may have a mental disease or defect, but that the trial counsel, the military judge, the members, the preliminary hearing officer. So preferred rating has to do with, at that point in the proceedings, we want to give appellant every opportunity to make the arguments.
So counsel, does it impact your analysis at all that, at least in theory, there's this question hanging out there, right, that if they had known at the time of trial that he had bipolar disorder as opposed to attention deficit disorder, right, at that time, wouldn't you have requested a 706 board based on what is in the medical records now?
Yes, Your Honor. If those same documents had been before the court during trial, I believe that would have met the standard in 706, which requires just a reasonable basis to believe there should be an inquiry. However, we're not there anymore. And
thank
so,
you. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was just going to say, in light of that, the government would ask this court to deny appellant's request and affirm the Army Court's judgment.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Can I ask you a question first? You can get to the podium before I ask it.
Of course, ma'am.
So, counsel, why to this day is there nothing linking the appellant's medical records to an inability to participate?
So
it appears from the CCA's opinion that the defense counsel refused to answer questions that would have created that link. And so my question to you is, why shouldn't we require you to make that link, which is what the rule requires, before anything else happens?
So, Your Honor.
Because otherwise we're creating the possibility of a rule that all you have to do is show that you had a lot of mental issues, right? And that per se means that you can't participate in your appellate proceedings, which, of course, that's not the rule and it's not the law.
Yes, Your Honor. Under the facts of this particular case, and just to be clear, I served as appellate defense counsel before the Army Court, and our position was that the standard, and still is that the standard is merely a substantial question, which this court interpreted as a non-frivolous good faith basis, and in light of multiple involuntary commitments, the incident at the school with the FBI agent,
as far as I know, that's not the rule. Those are historical facts, right? They're historical facts. They're not present facts. And so why, because otherwise the rule would be, whenever anyone has an extensive history of mental illness, they have created, therefore there is a substantial question whether they can participate in the proceedings.
Yes, Your Honor. And
as far as I know, that's not the law.
I don't think that.
I mean, it doesn't seem to be asking too much to require you to make a representation, or in writing or otherwise, that my client is unable to participate in the appellate proceedings. He doesn't understand. He can't understand.
Yes, Your Honor. If this court
As opposed to, he sat down and talked with me about Grostefan issues and this, that, and the other thing.
If this court found that was dispositive to this particular case,
that's what the rule requires.
Our position, respectfully, Your Honor, is that it doesn't. It requires a substantial question, and in light of
the question is the nexus, right? There has to be a nexus between the mental disease or defect and the ability to participate.
Yes, and our position, and we believe that nexus was met at the very least by the two California mental health courts' adjudication.
Those are historical facts. Those aren't present facts. And we're talking about the present. You need to show that in the present, at this time, there is an inability, because the rule goes on to talk that then you will evade the proceedings until they regain their ability, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And for that, so in order to kind of bring this to address the historical versus present, I would reference back to Dr. Hirsch's diagnosis that talks about his bipolar disorder having ongoing impacts on his cognitive functioning, his impulse control. To Judge Olson's point, this is a sine wave. It's an ongoing thing. If this court believed that it was dispositive in this case, which again, in light of the mountain of evidence regarding his severe mental health issues, we don't believe it's necessary. But if this court were to determine that an affidavit from counsel was necessary, then we could provide that. But it starts to impinge on the attorney-client relationship, and perhaps when we get to the when or if this were to come to a stage of an actual challenge to his mental responsibility and a petition for a new trial, then perhaps at that point that might be time for an affidavit from counsel. But in light of the evidence in this particular case at this time, we simply didn't believe that it was necessary.
Mr. Chief Judge, may I ask you a question? What is our current responsibility before this court to determine whether your client is capable of participating in the appeal before this court? Are you suggesting that there's a substantial question currently as to whether your client can participate in the appeal that we're conducting right now?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that in light of the bipolar diagnosis, there is absolutely a substantial question as to Specialist Navarette's cooperation and ability to intelligently work with myself and Captain Borland throughout every stage of his representation. And critically, in my last point, pending other questions, would be that this court has the authority not just to remand this case to the CCA to order hearings pursuant to 1203C5, but in United States versus Collins from 2004, this court looks back, this court itself actually ordered a post-trial 706 inquiry under those circumstances. And it ordered that inquiry not just into present mental capacity, but into his past capacity at the time of trial, as well as his mental responsibility at the time of the offense. In light of the fact that the Army Court had all of this information before it, and it still denied appellant a post-trial 706, that this court simply nipped this in the bud, so to speak, and itself order the post-trial 706.
But RCM 1203 is specifically within talking about the authority of the CCAs, not the authority of this court.
Two answers, Your Honor. It is in the subsection 1203, which is entitled Criminal Courts of Appeal. Our position is that this is also a criminal court of appeal. However,
well, how can you say that when the next article refers to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces?
Yes, Your Honor, we're cognizant of that. But that's why I would point this court to the actual plain language of the rule, which does not use the word criminal court of appeals and instead uses the phrase appellate authority. And this court in Collins clearly interpreted appellate authority to include this court. This court has the precedent to support ordering the 706 itself.
And counsel, I apologize for continuing to beat a dead horse, perhaps, but when the CCA specifically used as one of the bases for denying the request the fact that it has not asserted any actual claim that appellant is unable to understand, right? Why are you trying to make this so hard on yourself? Why don't you just do as the CCA had requested? Right? I mean, you're making an easy job much more difficult.
Your Honor,
you're asking us to make a very broad ruling based on historic facts as opposed to a narrow ruling based on a representation by you that he's unable to participate. And so I don't understand why the government's fighting so hard, I don't understand why you're fighting so hard.
Your Honor, our position is that it potentially leads to a dangerous precedent where the court is attempting to peel back the curtain to look into the actual conversations between the attorney.
I don't think that a mere representation that they're unable to participate is peeling back any curtain. It's a representation.
But yes, Your Honor. And if all we're looking
creating
at
creating a nexus between the historical documents and present day.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's precisely what the filing of the motion to abate and or stay the proceedings.
But you still don't say it. You never say the words. You don't say that he can't help, that he can't participate. You don't say that he can't understand. You don't say that your relationship is impinged upon. You say nothing like that. You just say he has all these problems. We want a 706 hearing.
Looking back to all the way back to Nix again, and
but
Your
we're
Honor,
not
I see
at Nix. We're at a new rule.
Well, one of the, what Nix observed, however, Your Honor, was that the spirit of the rule, which it said was rooted in 18 U.S.C. 4244, which is still the federal equivalent detailing sanity inquiries, that, and I will quote, when the claim of insanity is not frivolous, to allow the court to determine there is no reason, or excuse me, no cause to believe an accused may be insane or otherwise incompetent would be inconsistent with the legislative purpose. It's not for consideration, or, you know, it's not readily apparent to the eye of the layperson. I'm an attorney, counsel. This is why we need the post-trial 706, Your Honor, is that my representation that I believe that he is not currently competent is one that I'm simply not qualified to make. I can point to the fact he broke into a school. I can point to the fact he was deemed gravely disabled. Point to the fact he's been involuntarily committed for 16 weeks. I don't, however, as a non-medical professional, know precise understand how that relates to the legal standard. That's for the psychiatrist, and that's why we asked for the 706, Your Honor.
Okay, but the problem there is then you are folding in that as long as someone has medical records saying that they have had mental problems, that therefore, ergo aque, that they cannot be competent, unless there's a 706 board that says that they are.
I think that this court could easily cabin this case given the extreme details. I don't think that this court needs to find that in every instance that somebody puts forth a record. And again, like in Shaw, with the mere reference to bipolar disorder, that was insufficient to render or to raise a substantial question about the guilty plea. But that's not what we've done here. We've presented
a number of historical facts, yes.
Pending further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Because counsel got substantial extra time, I will offer the government an opportunity to say anything you want to say in 3 minutes or so. Thank you. Case is submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides, and court is in recess until 09:30 tomorrow.